The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to
discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system,
improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And the Dagoba Group,
a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice
with specialties in unconscious bias,
leadership dynamics, and client engagement.
Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend.
More at thedagobagroup.com.
Word of mouth. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Although losing ground to Ben Carson in Iowa, Donald Trump is still leading the GOP field nationally.
We are led by very, very stupid people. Very, very stupid people. We cannot let it continue.
To some, Trump's simplistic rhetoric and bombastic swipes at rivals reveal that he's too crude to hold high office. But it's working on a broad level. According to a recent review by the Boston Globe, that may be because Trump's speeches operate at the fourth grade level. The Globe put 19 candidates' speeches through a readability algorithm used to assess grade levels in schools. Matt Visor is national political reporter for the Globe, and he wrote about the results. Hi, Matt, and welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, what did you use to test the candidate speeches?
So there is a scoring system that is used by different publishers when they're putting out books for kids or to review scientific papers to see how general they are in readability. So we put the candidates' announcement speeches, which gave us a little bit of a apples-to-apples comparison, through the same scoring system, which looks at number of syllables per word, number of words per sentence, and things like that would kind of give you a sense on the complexity of language and how easy to understand different people are when they're speaking or when they're writing.
So Trump came in dead last at the fourth grade level. How did the others in the Republican field stack up?
Yeah, Trump was at the fourth grade. Ben Carson, who's also doing quite well in the polls, was almost next at about a sixth grade level. Some of the more complicated candidates, Bernie Sanders is at a 10th grade level. Mike Huckabee is around the same level, as is Carly Fiorina. And sort of in the middle of the pack, you know, around an 8th grade level or so, was Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio and Rand Paul, and along with Hillary Clinton, is about the 8th grade levels.
How about some examples of what makes Trump speeches 4th grade level?
Well, the sentences are very, very short, and, you know, how stupid are our leaders, you know, he'll say, or how stupid are they? You know, he'll repeat things over and over again. He says, I'm really rich. Politicians are all talk, no action. His sentences are only a few words, and those words are only a few syllables. So that's what kind of puts him at a low level, at least on this scoring system. He tends to, you know, this analysis didn't necessarily capture that, but he tends to often use the same vocabulary words a lot, you know, huge or terrible or beautiful. And, you know, it's not a huge range in terms of vocabulary that he's using.
We are going to start winning big league on trade, militarily. We're going to build up our military. We're going to have such a strong military that nobody is going to mess with us. We're not going to have to use it.
So, to be clear, this ranking has nothing to do with intelligence or education. It's just speech, right?
That's right. And so it is, in essence, looking at what level the candidates are trying to speak in order for people to comprehend what they are saying. It doesn't gauge what level they have capacity to speak or understand. Ben Carson is one of the lowest on this scoring system. But he has a medical degree and has a renowned history as a brain surgeon. You know, by all means, is an intelligent person. Donald Trump went to Wharton, you know, as he reminds us frequently. You know, he went to Wharton and has a graduate degree from one of the most prestigious business schools in the country. So I think that there is an element in here that does not capture necessarily the intelligence of the person. And in fact, you may argue that they're being more intelligent by trying to cater their speech to capture the broadest slice of the electorate as they can.
Well, so the suggestion is that the plain speak works. Why?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Trump, his language is very simple. It's very easy to understand. There's no sort of nuance to it. I talked with one of President Obama's former speechwriters who made the point that he always took pride when Obama's speeches were at a lower grade level because it meant that they were easily understood. And he noted that one of the most inspirational political phrases in the past decade or so was Obama's campaign slogan of "Yes, we can." You know, it's three words, one syllable each. It's very simple. And in fact, you know, there's been various studies that have looked at State of the Union addresses or speeches by members of Congress. And those have shown also that language has gotten much simpler, you know, or dumbed down, you know, depending on how you looked at it. John F. Kennedy in his 1961 State of the Union was speaking at almost a 14th grade level, you know, sort of collegiate level speeches. Obama's have consistently been at an 8th grade level in terms of his State of the Union addresses. So there does seem to be more of a conscious effort in the part of speechwriters and candidates themselves to sort of dumb their speech down a little bit.
What does being a great speechmaker have to do with great leadership? Do you think there is any kind of correlation?
Well, to the degree that you're trying to move public opinion, whether it's public opinion toward your candidacy or it's public opinion toward your policy as a president, there is an advantage, I think, to being able to lead through speeches and being able to lead people through your rhetoric. And so I think that there is an upside to having good speech writers and having a good team. And that's actually another aspect is that has made language probably simpler is the increase in terms of speech writers. I mean, you have professionals on your staff whose sole job it is to figure out how you can translate your thoughts into ideas that can be understood by a mass market. That didn't used to exist, you know, 30 or 40 years ago. So JFK was doing a lot of his speeches, and presidents before him were doing a lot of their speeches. And as a result, they were more complicated. They were sort of the thoughts of very educated men putting their thoughts on paper and reading them aloud.
So what gets lost when you're trying to communicate, you know, concepts that do actually operate on the collegiate or above level at language that everybody can understand?
I mean, I think sometimes what gets lost is the nuances of policy. You hope that leaders don't get to a stage that they think that the American public is unable to understand complex policies or things that have broad impacts.
Well, Matt Visor, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Matt Visor is national political reporter for the Boston Globe, and you can see an easy-to-comprehend graphic of which grade level the candidates end up in according to the Globe's review of their speeches, along with Matt's analysis and article. It's called "For Presidential Hopefuls, Simpler Language Resonates." Links are at wordofmouthradio.org. Well, we wanted to give you a sense of how presidential speeches have changed through the decades. So we collected some excerpts from State of the Union speeches, starting with John Kennedy in 1963, Richard Nixon in 1970, Bill Clinton in 1998, and George W. Bush in 2005. Take a listen and see if you think presidential language has grown simpler or more accessible over time.
The quality of American life must keep pace with the quantity of American goods. This country cannot afford to be rich and desperately poor.
The State of the Union address is traditionally an occasion for a lengthy and detailed account by the president of what he has accomplished in the past, what he wants the Congress to do in the future, and in an election year, to lay the basis for the political issues which might be decisive in the fall. Occasionally, there comes a time when profound and far-reaching events command a break with tradition. This is such a time.
With barely 700 days left in the 20th century, this is not a time to rest. It is a time to build the America within reach. An America where everybody has a chance to get ahead with hard work, where every citizen can live in a safe community, where families are strong, schools are good, and all our young people can go on to college.
Our generation has been blessed by the expansion of opportunity, by advances in medicine, by security purchased by our parents' sacrifice. Now, as we see a little gray in the mirror, or a lot of gray, and we watch our children moving into adulthood, we ask the question, what will be the state of their union?
Excerpts from State of the Union speeches there from JFK, Nixon, Clinton, and George W. Bush.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Presidential debate season is just hitting its stride with a handful behind us and plenty more to come. Voters are looking for clarity and specifics on where the respective candidates stand on the issues. Well, not everyone is so eager to hear the details, especially if they have some serious skin in the game. Darren Samuelson is senior policy reporter at Politico. He recently wrote about how policy experts and lobbyists and lawmakers watch the presidential debates differently than the rest of us. He joins us now to explain. Hello, Darren.
Good afternoon.
Well, in your article, you write that a lot of policy experts, affectionately termed wonks there in D.C., hope that candidates steer clear of certain topics. Why?
It's fascinating. If you think about it, these debates are seen on different levels by different people. The typical voter might be looking for personality, might be looking to decide if this is someone that they would trust to have the keys for nuclear weapons or America's troops. But in Washington and really around the country, you have lobbyists, you have experts on everything from transportation to energy to tax policy, who are listening very closely for details that might be spoken about, where a signal might be given of where they might be going. And in this case, where you have a free-for-all Republican presidential campaign and the same thing on the Democratic side to some extent, the candidates are tempted to maybe step a little bit further than anyone would like them to go and make promises they can't keep or influence an active legislative or international negotiation that's already happening right now that can really kind of tip the scales in some directions. And they'd rather just hear nothing on their topic than hear something.
So they watch the debates holding their breath, hoping that these ideas won't get floated because then they'll get picked up on?
Exactly. Yeah, they don't want the candidates to go into extremes to even bring up a topic that maybe wouldn't otherwise come up. But, you know, in these debates, the candidates often will speak in secret codes in some respect. You know, they'll be talking about something that maybe only a couple people really know what it is that they're talking about. But it can have significant effects. I'll give you just one great example. It was sort of at the end of, I think it was the second debate, where Ben Carson made a comment about telephones and the government. A lot of people took that to mean he was talking about what are called the Obama phone, which is a something that has been around in government for a long, long time. These are phones that help people connect the medical care, and it's become a political hot button topic, though. And anything kind of with that Obama label on it can become instant political pinata. Another great example would be high speed rail, which was a big issue there at the beginning of the Obama administration. And just people do not want to hear talk about high-speed rail, which is still moving forward in California and Texas primarily. They just don't want to have the politicians bringing that down.
It's so counterintuitive. I would imagine that, you know, policy wonks thinking, oh, I hope they talk about high-speed rail because then it actually might go somewhere.
Yeah, you do hear that with the climate change advocates too. A lot of them are advocating and talking about how they want the Republican presidential candidates to be asked where do they stand on global warming and emissions policy. But then you have some other Republican policy wonks, especially out there, who do want to see some proactive action from this next administration, if it is a GOP administration, and if everyone on the stage is being urged like to follow Donald Trump and take the position of climate change isn't real, you can box yourself in. You can put yourself in a position where you are not in a position to govern going forward if you do become the president of the United States, and you do have to make some pretty important decisions on EPA emission regulations, on fuel economy standards, negotiating with Congress. And if you've said on the stage that you don't believe global warming is real because Donald Trump started that ball rolling, that could put you in a climate advocate in a tough spot.
So even if their issues are not ready for prime time, you're pretty sure all of these wonks are watching, right?
They're all watching the debate, no doubt about it. They want to see what the candidates are talking about. And obviously, it puts them into interesting places the day after the debate. I mean, if your issue does get mentioned, you do need to snap into instant lobbying mode to make sure the lawmakers and the interest groups up in Washington, either they heard what the candidate said and they might want to quickly kind of fill in the between the lines, because not a lot of detail does get mentioned in these debates. But it does put a lot of PR people, a lot of lobbyists, a lot of nonprofits on edge if their issue does come up in terms of trying to engage with everyday Washington.
How does that language or spectrum of issues in the primaries differ from that of the general elections? You know, does that feed into the concern for policy experts?
It does indeed, yeah. In a primary where there's 15 candidates debating on the Republican stage especially, the lurch is to the right. The lurch is trying to get as many conservatives excited about your campaign, which does put you in a difficult position if you do ultimately become the nominee and are running in a general election where you're trying to talk to a much wider audience of moderate Democrats, independents, people who do not vote in Republican primaries or caucuses. And so it's a big challenge on the policy front. It happens the same in the Democratic side, where Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders are bashing the banks and really trying to speak to the engaged voters who do show up and do take the time to vote in the primaries and the caucuses. They say things that could get them in trouble when they do try and appeal to that middle of the road segment of the country that isn't paying attention right now, but will be once we get to October of 2016 and they're starting to tune in for the very first time in those presidential debates.
Well, in addition to people who are working on transportation, there were also those you spoke to who were in tax reform, concerned about multinational corporations being talked about in terms of tax reform. And also criminal justice reform advocates told you it all pretty much depends on who talks first. Why would that matter?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. That's an example where we're talking about military sexual assault, an issue that has kind of taken on an unusual split up on Capitol Hill that's been a lively debate. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand from New York has been leading that campaign. And so basically what you have here among the Republican candidates is a couple, Ted Cruz and Rand Paul, who have taken the position that they really want to see some shaking up of the military justice system, and contrary to where the Pentagon is. But you have Marco Rubio, who has been engaged in this debate, who has taken the side of the Pentagon, saying, well, hold on, let's let some reforms that we've been putting in place go forward. So on that question, which really hasn't come up yet in the debates, but it is certainly primed to come up on not just maybe on military sexual assault, but and campus sexual assault. College campuses have had a wrath of these criminal incidents and rapes, and it's been a high-profile story. You have some advocates who would rather not see Marco Rubio get the question first, again, for that fear that he would take the side of the Pentagon, and then that would flush out the rest of the field to sort of take the pro-Pentagon side. I know there's a lot of chess pieces moving around here, but if Rubio were to speak first, that could leave Jeb Bush, it could lead Donald Trump and Ben Carson to take his side. Whereas a lot of these advocates for changes on sexual assault might prefer Ted Cruz and Rand Paul to get the question first to give their side of the story and potentially sway people to take a little bit different position. Again, it's counting votes up in the Capitol, which is happening. You know, the Congress is watching these debates on the presidential stage with an eye on where the votes are on various issues, including this one.
It's so interesting to think about the dynamics going on backstage, the debates, as a lot more involved than what's going on stage. And these candidates, they just come up with these things pretty much on the fly, or are they really well prepped?
They're prepped to a degree. I think each candidate might be prepped a little bit more than others. They have different styles as well. Donald Trump seems to, as these debates have gone further, maybe a little bit more prepped than he was at the very beginning. They do have the beginnings of policy teams. Some of them, I think Jeb Bush's, with all the money that Jeb Bush has, he has a pretty sophisticated policy apparatus of people who worked for his brother's administration who have prepped him and given him tons of briefing books. So he's thought about it a lot more than I think some of the other less funded candidates who don't have the resources available to be as nuanced in the 3 to 5, the 7-point plans that they might want to be talking about. And then, of course, they've been thundering and complaining about the fact that they haven't been getting these nuanced policy questions, but instead have been asked questions like about fantasy football or what are their greatest weaknesses. So you have this interesting contrast. This happens all the time that the presidential candidates will complain that they're not being asked the nuanced, weedy questions that maybe they're not actually equipped to answer if they do get them.
Well, we've been talking largely about the Republicans. We've got a lot more fodder there, I suppose, for a number of candidates. But we do have a Democratic debate coming up in just a few days. Any subjects you think policy wonks there will be hoping do not come up?
I think the biggest one there would be the banks. And both Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton have been pretty happy to kind of rip into Wall Street and to rip into the financial services industry without really any thoughts to what that could mean down the road in a general election. And yeah, you do have a lot of people in the tax industry and the financial industry who are watching a Democratic debate and with fingers in their ears, just kind of hoping that the rhetoric just tones down a little bit for fear of what it could mean once we get into a governing stage if Hillary Clinton was to be elected president.
Interesting exercise in control, I guess.
Indeed it is.
Darren Samuelson, senior policy reporter at Politico, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
And you'll find a link to read Darren's article, Hey Candidates, Please Don't Mention Us. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. Now, if you're a political junkie, make sure to download NHBR's new State of Democracy app. That'll keep you connected to the stories that matter from the 2016 campaign trail. It's easy to find at nhpr.org.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. From shadow puppets on the walls to Jim Henson's Muppets, the art of puppetry has entertained and captured the human imagination for millennia. And it remains alive and well in some theater circles, like the Banff Center Puppet Theater. But what does it take to be a truly gifted puppeteer? Brian Cawley brings us the story.
He's a little yeti, and he's about a foot high.
I don't know exactly what he is. He might be kind of a spaceman, a medieval astronaut, some sort of robot.
That is Chris Duthie.
I'm an actor and I am a performance creator.
And Tangle Karan.
I'm a participant in the Banff Puppetry Intensive Workshop.
They build puppets.
There's some twinkle in the eye. There's some shape of the nose. Puppet talks back to you.
And they give life to puppets.
You just do what the puppet tells you.
In January, they spent time at the Banff Center learning about puppetry.
My name is Juanita Dawn.
With people like Juanita Dawn.
I am facilitating the open studio at Puppet Intensive 2012.
Before I came to this workshop, I had a very different view of puppets.
Puppetry, a lot of people think of it and they think of Muppets or they think of hand puppets for little kids. Modern puppetry, though, is really in a state of renaissance, in a state of evolution.
The Puppet Intensive is this crazy, what would you call it?
It's basically a two weeks of crazy puppet chaos.
It's an interactive course.
It's a wonderful time to focus for an artist to be able to completely immerse in an art form. Puppetry combines lots of different mediums. It combines theater, it combines visual art, it combines movement.
So it's a magical combination. It's making a moving, magical installation.
Revolutionary things, pushing the boundaries of what we understand as theater and what we understand as art.
It's an absolutely amazing way to make art come alive.
Really, really fun, and it's an incredibly concentrated learning environment. I think I compared it at one point to drinking out of a fire hose because there's so much information coming at you and you're doing so much and you're working so many hours. It really is an intensive. There's time to eat, there's barely time to sleep, and there's time to do puppets.
You
you said doing puppets. What is doing puppets?
It's all to put all of the focus onto this object or this puppet, this thing that you were trying to give life.
Puppetry is a very physical art, the actual performance and manipulation of puppetry.
In order to clearly articulate a puppet's movements, you need to understand those movements in your body, because that's ultimately where they're coming from. You have to be completely engaged, sometimes more heavily, I think, than when you're performing, to clarify the relationship with puppeteering and manipulating puppets and working as an ensemble.
The group that I worked with, we did a shadow show. We built a giant cardboard set and then had some shadow puppetry in our show. We also had a lot of cooperative puppetry, which means several puppeteers manipulating the same puppet to bring it to life.
Somewhere between the rods and the fake fur, something wondrous emerges.
The energy flows right into that puppet, and it's alive. Whether it moves or speaks or shakes its head, that puppet becomes alive, and that's the magic of puppetry. No matter what the object is, a paper bag, a sock, a hand-carved marionette, the right person putting their energy into it creates that life. People put their own energy, their own spirit into the puppets, and therefore the puppets end up really looking a lot like them.
The puppet I made is kind of a spaceman. I was kind of conceiving him as a medieval spaceman, a medieval astronaut, but he didn't really turn out that way. I don't know exactly what he is. He might be some sort of robot, but he's kind of an earthy robot, I guess.
There's rods attached to his hands and feet to manipulate him. I also put a rod out the back, and he has a very simple, very primitive ball and socket joint on the head, and then just elastic joints on the elbows and the shoulders. And I ended up covering him with fake fur, so he's a little yeti, and he's about a foot high. You have a thing that is obviously inanimate on stage, and it comes to life, and it does amazing things. And then at the end, it goes back into the box, and it is simply an object again.
For me, puppets have taught me patience, and puppets have brought me lots of love.
I think puppets have taught me how to be humble.
And there's a saying that I learned in school about how actors should learn to act from puppets. I think it's probably true in some ways.
It's a wonderful art form for teachers. It's a wonderful art form for activists. It's a wonderful art form for anyone who's interested in magic.
And that story was produced by Brian Colley in association with the Banff Center.
Word of
mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
Heaven. I'm in
this is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. All movie genres go in and out of fashion. Take the Western, the rom-com, the biopic, slasher movies. But as historian Richard Barrios notes, the movie musical has been declared dead at least 6 times now. And again, they managed to rise up singing. But why? Why in the depths of the Depression did 42nd Street triumph? What made The Sound of Music and Oliver hits while Americans rioted in the streets? How did Les Miserables become an international phenom in the age of Hollywood pyrotechnics and reality TV? Well, Barrios proposes that behind their deceptively simple, glittering facades, musicals have a place in American culture beyond pure escapism. His book, Dangerous Rhythm, is full of razzly-dazzly hits, dismal flops, sharp criticism, and enough insider gossip to make the case. We spoke to him when the book was first released. It's now out in paperback. So what do you say when people say, oh, ugh, it's a musical, I hate musicals?
Oh, I tell them they're not alone, that this sort of thing happens a lot. Musicals divide people as much as politics do, really.
You spend a lot of time in the book on what makes them work and what does not. So let's just focus on a few. Why don't we look at Singin' in the Rain, and we've got a little music to set the tone.
I'm singing in the rain, just singing in the rain.
Okay, Richard Barrios, what made that musical work?
More than anything else, I think, and there's many great things to choose from in it, but it's a musical where the script matters as much as the songs and the dances. It's an incredibly witty script, and it is a way of sort of paying tribute to all of the movie musicals that came before it, because it starts at the very beginning of the sound era. So it encompasses all of movie musicals, and it does so very wittily and kind of nasty, too, occasionally, which I enjoy.
So how about the ones that didn't work? You can take your pick.
I can go to Paint Your Wagon. That's always a good target to hang to hang bullseyes on. They got a lot of people who could not sing, like Lee Marvin and Clint Eastwood. They spent way too much money by going to a remote part of Oregon that was prone to flooding, so they chose the location very poorly. And they tried to make it really hip and current, and it was neither of those things. So it was a total misfire of the wrong material, the wrong people, the wrong intentions, the wrong amount of money spent. So it was kind of a perfect storm.
Well, there is a special and precise bond that you write about between musicals and their audience, a mutually admiring kinship, you say, unintelligible to outsiders and quite fragile. When either side violates it, crises occur. What are some of the elements that go into that plot? It isn't always that someone has a great singing voice. It's not always a plausible plot. Some great singers and duds. Give us some of these elements.
It's sort of an intangible. It has to do with understanding how music and words can connect and then how they can be transmitted to an audience for the maximum amount of comprehension and empathy. You get something like Judy Garland, a great singer, singing Over the Rainbow. And it's a situation that people can understand, a girl from Kansas longing for a world of color and magic.
There's a land that I heard of once in a lullaby.
That's an example of where it all comes together because it's all been thought out. And the audience is always part of the equation. And sometimes movies leave out the audience and how they might respond. And that's when a movie musical does not matter, when it forgets about its audience.
Well, you just led me to something that also makes this book so interesting, inside view of how films are produced. Over the Rainbow almost didn't make it into The Wizard of Oz.
At one point, a number of MGM producers wanted to cut it. They said, why should Judy go around singing in the barnyard? Imagine what that would have been like.
But back to this point that it has to matter in order to be successful. Don't all films have to matter to be successful?
Well, with escapism, mattering is sort of a relative concept. It doesn't have to be totally connected with current events, for example, but it has to offer something beneath the surface, I think, some sort of resonance, strike some sort of responsive chord. And that was one of the reasons that so many big musicals like Paint Your Wagon and Hello, Dolly, coming in at the end of the 1960s, seemed so clueless because there was so much difficult going on in the world. You had Vietnam, you had riots in the United States. And here come these movies with sort of mindless optimism that seemed really willfully offensive, even because it seemed to totally disregard what was going on. And a musical can maybe make people happy in a difficult situation or unhappy situation, but it can't be oblivious.
Well, even if My Fair Lady, Hello Dolly, Camelot in the 1960s were tone deaf, there are movies like 42nd Street, which is a great hit during the Depression. Doesn't a musical have to be out of date somewhat to transport us?
Well, 42nd Street was as timely as a film could be because it came in right as President Roosevelt was being inaugurated, and Warner Brothers promoted it with Roosevelt's own slogan, New Deal. They promoted it as a New Deal in entertainment. And it gave Depression-weary audiences hope, because here's this totally unknown girl, Ruby Keeler, who becomes a star. And it said, well, if this nobody can make it big, maybe you can get out of the Depression too.
Hmm. I got it! Well, what is it? A penny?
A nickel?
Will you hold your horses and let me get the dirt off? A dime! We're in the money! We're in the money!
And following the 60s, of course, the 1970s, a time of still continuing struggle in the U.S., not a great age for the movie musical, but you single out one, Cabaret, what, 72, 74, I can't recall.
72.
Why did it work?
Well, for one thing, it paid attention to the world around it. It connected a lot of the unrest going on in the entire world by that time, from the 60s and early 70s, with the rise of Nazi Germany. And it did so in a very sort of hard-edged, unsentimental way. There weren't nuns defeating these Nazis or anything like that. It seemed relevant. And with Bob Fosse in charge, it was very hard-edged. The editing was much sharper than most films had tried to be musically before then. So it really connected with audiences. But then after that, musicals just sort of faded away. You had things like MAME and Lost Horizon, which seemed totally clueless. And something like that's going to alienate a large part of the population, and that's what happened.
MAME with Lucille Ball, a hit on television. What was it? The New York Times columnist Pauline Kael said about her.
Did she do her own singing, or was she dubbed by Dick Cavett?
While you can ponder that question, we'll listen to a little bit from Maybe This Time. This is Liza Minnelli's pretty transcendent performance in Cabaret.
Everybody loves a winner, so nobody loved me. Lady Peaceful, Lady Happy, that's what I long to be. Well, all the odds are they're in my favor. Something's bound to begin. It's gotta happen, happen sometime. Maybe this time I'll win.
We're talking about this submerged movie genre that keeps resurfacing, the musical. Richard Barrios is with us. He worked in the music and film industry before turning to film history, and his new book is called Dangerous Rhythm, Why Movie Musicals Matter. Makes the case that musicals are surprisingly sophisticated bellwethers of American culture, taste, preference, and even politics. I want to stay on that connection to the real world and look at musicals as one of the more integrated refuges in Hollywood for African Americans, for sexuality in the days of the Hays Code, the Motion Picture Production Code, and homosexuality on film. Why, Richard Barrios, do musicals get a pass in those forbidden places?
Well, I think part of it was because entertainment actually had higher profile gay and lesbian people and African Americans participating in them. And so many of the early musicals were backstage theatrical stories. And since these personalities were part of that life, it was sort of easier to bring them along. The very first musical film, as we now consider musicals, was The Broadway Melody, which opened early in 1929, and it featured very prominently a gay costume designer. A few months after that, the early musical On With the Show, which was also a backstage story, featured the wonderful recording and stage performer Ethel Waters introducing the song Am I Blue and totally hitting it out of the ballpark.
I think
so. And this sort of continued on. It waxed and waned, but by the 1940s, you had Ethel Waters again with Lena Horne in the great musical Cabin in the Sky. You had the Nicholas Brothers and Lena Horne in Stormy Weather. And you had very covert but nevertheless detectable to people who understood gay presences in movies like Lady in the Dark and Broadway Rhythm, some of those things.
Well, let's hear just a little bit of that. This is Lena Horne singing Stormy Weather. Let's talk about the medium of film for a moment. Making things matter, as you point out, is not simply adapting a successful Broadway show for film, nor does it work the other way around. What is it specifically about the medium of film that makes it fly or not?
Well, one of the mistakes I think that a lot of live shows are making now that are adapted from movies is that they try to copy movie techniques onto the live stage. And these are two completely different mediums, and they should not be confused with one another. They should not overlap. And I wish they'd stop trying to adapt animated films into live stage shows. It doesn't really work. Lion King was good, and they should have stopped there.
Well, I was going to stop you on that because I would say Lion King did work. But the whole idea of the musical, it is pretty awkward and silly in its own way, right? I mean, I'm thinking
it can be.
Well, I'm thinking of that, you know, in the Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Did you ever see that movie?
Oh, yes.
Okay,
yes.
So you have the Scottish father who, you know, when his son, you hear the music start to swell and his son is posing like he's about to sing and he's saying, no, stop the music. There's not going to be any singing.
Exactly. And really, song cues and that sort of thing have been a target since the very beginning of musicals and sound in the late 1920s, even. You see some early musicals make fun of some of those conventions because they are silly. And let's face it, musicals do have to occupy their own particular world with a certain kind of suspension of disbelief.
Well, why do you think we're willing to suspend disbelief for a musical?
I think the best answer to that would come in the way that a really good musical can give the effect of making dreams seem tangible. They sort of tap into our subconscious and provide these brilliant, when they're done well, illustrations of what we dream about and what we think about. And, you know, to make fantasies seem real is quite an achievement. And musicals do it in a very specific way. And it's a way that the tenor of the times isn't always connected with, which is why they go in and out of fashion so much.
Well, we just scraped the surface, Richard Barrios, but I want to thank you so much for your time.
It's been great talking to you. Thank you so much.
Historian Richard Barrios, author of Dangerous Rhythm, Why Movie Musicals Matter. It's now available in paperback.
Come on, babe, why don't we paint the town? And all that jazz I'm gonna...
Thanks so much for your listening time today. There is much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And if you missed any of today's show, you can catch it in its entirety with the Word of Mouth podcast. You can subscribe at wordofmouthradio.org or search for Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, please rate it or tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back tomorrow, too, with more Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio.
And all that jazz.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
Megan Tan, and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our volunteer is Pam Maroney.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.